X. The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Merry meet and merry part, bright the cheeks and warm the heart. For tread the circle thrice about to keep unwelcome spirits out. Bide within the law you must, in perfect love. Trust. Mind the threefold laws you should, three times bad and three times good. These eight words the reed fulfill, and ye harm none to what ye will.
Welcome to Stirring the Cauldron. Now, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Hey, merry meet everybody, and welcome to Stirring the Cauldron. Tonight, we're talking about how using common plants to create uncommon magic. We're talking about that with our author, J.D. Walker, and she wrote a book called A Witch's Guide to Wildcraft. Now, J.D. is a master gardener and a vice chancellor of the House of Akasha, which is a North Carolina pagan group, a former business journalist and a garden columnist for 30 years, or almost anyway. She's contributed dozens of articles to Llewellyn's Almanacs, and I'm very glad that she's here tonight. Now, as always, chat room comments and questions are always welcome, and the chat room can be found at paraxradionetwork.com if you care to join us. J.D., welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Marla.
Interesting book. Before I knew what it was, Wildcraft. That sounds good. Whatever it is, it really sounds good. And even better when it comes to plants. But getting right down to basics right off the bat, what is wildcraft?
Wildcraft, at least from my interpretation, is going out and harvesting the plants that grow naturally. We garden, certainly, and you can grow a lot of magical herbs and plants either in your landscape or in a proper garden. But usually when we talk about wildcraft, we mean going and picking something that volunteered on its own or that is just naturally growing wherever you find it. A lot of times when we say wildcraft, people think exotic, like ginseng root. You would have to forage long and hard to find ginseng root. But it doesn't have to mean exotic. Certainly plantain, that weed that grows in your yard every year, is not exotic, but it's a wonderful, magical plant.
Now, right off the bat, I saw something in the book that, this is true right off the bats tonight, that it was something that I never gave a thought to before. But when I saw the question that you said, what is an herb, I wondered why I never asked myself that or even thought to wonder about the definition. I mean, I guess I just took it for granted that herbs were something that we cooked with or used in spell work. But those were the only definitions that I knew in my head. But in case, now that I've mentioned it, maybe a couple people listening in might want to find out exactly what herbs are also. So can you answer the question?
Yes, definitely. And that was an interesting question that came up in the editing process. We have a lot of different definitions of herbs. Generally, the general public would say that an herb is the tissue part, the leafy part, possibly even the flower part of an herb, and a spice is the bark or the seed or the hull, in some cases also the root, of a plant. Those are the, I guess it comes close to saying the cooking definitions of what herbs are. If you get into herbal medicine, that definition expands so that an herbalist would say that the roots that you take out of the ground would be an herb. That would not be correct from a botanist standpoint, but it's certainly correct from an herbalist standpoint. I make a point in the book to say that we use things like oak bark, and we use resins from pine trees. We use the various nuts that you can find, or for that matter, the lichens and funguses that we can find on trees. Those all have magical purposes. But when we say those as magical workers, we say herb. So the definition is very, very broad. Again, the point that I make in the book is that we come closest to the herbalist definition, the medicinal herbalist definition of what an herb is, than we would what a botanist or a biologist might say when he or she is talking about herbs.
Is there a difference between like regular herbs and magical herbs, or can all herbs be considered magical if they're used for spell work?
Generally speaking, all herbs that you have in your kitchen cabinet have some sort of magical purpose, or can be applied for magical purpose. If I'm thinking right off the top of my head about things like sage, basil, garlic, oregano, ginger, all of those things that we normally think of as culinary herbs also have a magical aspect to them. They have a characteristic. They have an energy, so that we talk about, for instance, ginger having a fiery energy. So you can take that quality and apply it to your magic. This isn't creating things out of whole cloth, just trying to dream up your own associations for herbs. There is frequently a lot of history in this. There's a reason why certain plant materials became commonly used. And yes, they're tasty, or yes, they might help to soothe a sore throat, for instance, things like slippery elm. But people also took those qualities historically and applied it for magical purposes too. This is the doctrine of signatures that we talk about, like to like. If a plant has a fiery constitution, it brings fire to your spell work. If a plant has a watery constitution, for instance, chickweed is one that we talk about in this book. I went over about 30 different common herbs. I wasn't trying to find every single common plant that you might find in your landscape or yard or along the side of your particular road as you're driving to and from work. But I did try to pick some of the more common ones, and chickweed is a very common herb. It has a watery constitution. It is ascribed to the moon. So it has a cooling effect. It has a lunar effect when you use it in your spell work. So that kind of a long, drawn-out way of saying, if you look closely at your kitchen cabinet, kitchen herb rack, you will find that quite a lot of those herbs will have a magical component that historically has been applied to a lot of different spell work.
Yeah, I found that kind of interesting. I never gave it much thought. I mean, when you were talking about the heat in ginger, I was thinking of cayenne or peppers and things like that. I'm not sure that I can. I probably don't know what the watery ones are, because that doesn't jump up into my head. But yeah, and there, I'm sure there's herbs that are little prickly herbs, little things. And so, yeah, I can see now, maybe not necessarily by looking at them, but by tasting them or if they're edible, just finding that out. But you have a great deal of information in your book about each herb that you've got in there. And there are dozens and dozens of herbs in this world. So I know you tried to keep it like North American things that are easiest to find, but how did you just get it down to like 30-ish?
Well, again, it was trying to come up. I'm not sure. Are you familiar with USDA plant zones?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And for your readers who may not be familiar, the United States is divided into 11 zones You'll hear people talk about plant hardiness zones of 5, 7. It goes down to 11. Obviously, it goes up to 0. You have to get up to the northern reaches of Canada to get into the 0 range. But generally speaking, the North American continent is largely covered by zones 5 through 9. We do have areas that are plant zones 3 and 4. We do have those subtropic areas, a few of them, that are zones 10 and 11. That's usually the coastal, like the tip of Florida, things like that. But the bulk of our plants are growing in plant zones from about 5 to 9. So I was trying to narrow it down to those plants that could most readily be found through most of the United States. A good example of that would be, for instance, poke root or poke weed. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you have poke weed in Ohio. And I was kind of surprised many years ago when I went to a gardening conference in Michigan, I believe it was, and saw a beautiful Ikebana arrangement using pokeberries, just stems of pokeberries that were ripe at the time, because I honestly didn't think pokeroot would grow that far north, but obviously it does. Mm-hmm. But basically, I was trying to select those plants that would be most likely to be found through the major plant zones in the United States. I hope it will have some applications outside the United States. A lot of these plants came to us from Europe, a few of them from Asia. Plantain, for instance, got the name white man's foot when the Native Americans learned of it from European settlers, because they grew it for the leaf and also for the seeds, for some of the medicinal use of it. And the legend was that everywhere white men went, that plant was following along with them. So it has some applications outside of the United States, but given our readership, I was basically trying to find some of the most common plants you would probably be able to locate in your particular area. And that, if I can expand on that just a little
sure,
bit.
Sure, please.
That gets to one of the main purposes of the book. I love the fact that I can get frankincense. Now, you can't grow frankincense for love or money in most of the United States. There are a few places in Arizona and Southern California where they're trying to farm it, try to turn it into a commercial crop, so to speak. But basically, that's Mediterranean, Saudi Arabian, East African plant. It just doesn't grow everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I love having those. I think that's a wonderful component for magic. But if I want to really grow and develop as a magical practitioner, I need to be able to relate to things that are outside my house, outside my door, things that I see readily as I go through my day-to-day life. That's how I feel like we pull the magic into our life. If you are simply buying your magical supplies at a store or online, you don't get that depth of experience. The point that you made, for instance, with the herbs, saying, you know, I can't really relate to the herbs. I don't really know for sure about the watery nature of an herb in my kitchen cabinet. That's true. But if you saw it growing in your environment, you would very quickly realize, now I see why this is a watery herb. Now I understand the associations that come with this particular herb. And having that knowledge helps you to understand the plant better, understand your magic better, and better utilize the herbs that you use in your magical workings.
So how do herbs enrich our magical workings?
That's interesting. A lot of people, this is something my own little hang up here. Some people don't put a whole lot of emphasis on the herbs themselves. I'm a bit of a stickler for that. The herbs that we use have certain energies mm-hmm. that we can bring into our spell work. Because I gardened for many years, I taught gardening landscape classes. I did landscape work as a profession for a great deal of time. I used to tell people that you could take grass seed in North Carolina in the southern reaches of the state, throw it out in the middle of July in the heat that we get down here in the middle of summer, not necessarily irrigate it, and that grass may grow. But chances are it won't. So if you understand the herbs and how they grow, then you can bring that energy into your magic. So, for instance, grass has a protective energy. It has an abundance energy. And you know that because if you look at grass, it grows with abundance. It regenerates. You cut it every time you go out there and cut your lawn. You mm-hmm. cut that grass back. And a few days later, by golly, it's up and it's growing like weeds again. That kind of energy can be brought into your spell work. That lends the energy to your purpose. It's one of those things that you can go through the steps, like you're cooking, you're baking a cake when you do your magical work. But having the right herb gathered in the right manner, processed in the right manner, respectfully, and taken care of, lends the energy of that plant, whatever that plant's energy is, to your intent. Now, you can do this. For instance, a story that I tell about my mother, she used to tell us that if we really focused, it didn't matter if your brother was screaming in the other room and the television was blaring in the living room, you should be able to focus well enough that you could still do your work. And it's true. Mm-hmm. But it really, really helps if you have everything going in your favor. So you can go and do your spell work without crystals, without candles, without herbs. And if your intent is strong and your focus is strong, you can probably do successful spell work. But it helps to have as much as possible going in your favor, and that's where the herbs come in. They lend a fiery energy, if that's what you happen to need. They lend an airy energy, if you gather the right herb, if that's what you need. They give you a grounding energy, if that's what you happen to need and you pick the right plant. They provide that extra energy that you need to accomplish your end. I don't know very many people who are such great magical workers that they can do without any kind of accoutrement, tools, candles, herbs, whatever. I'm sure there are some out there. I hope some of your listeners are those kinds of strong practitioners. But most of us need a little help. And that's what we get from the various herbs that we use.
I was just looking at planetary correspondences with certain plants. And, you know, like you have a nighttime hours chart in here. Mm-hmm. And so some of these things, I mean, I know are herbs, but you're talking about also geraniums, for example, mm-hmm. or what am I thinking? Honeysuckle, maybe. Mm-hmm. Morning glory. Are they considered herbs?
Yes. In a magical working, any plant that you utilize for your magical working gets the general label of herb. We have to get away from the notion of if it's not something that I find in my kitchen spice rack, it's not an herb. No, it is most definitely an herb. So we think about this. I'm sure there must be some magic shops, supply shops in your general area. I hope you've got a good magic shop somewhere nearby.
Yeah.
And you go in and you see, hopefully you will see on their shelves, jars after jars after jars of quote unquote herbs.
Mm-hmm.
And I will guarantee that in amongst all those herbs, you will find stuff like galanga mm-hmm. or hajan. Both of those are in the morning glory family. Mm-hmm. These are the ipomeas. You will find things like honeysuckle, a little less common, but honeysuckle is a great prosperity herb and psychic herb, actually. So again, you look at that just row after row of plant material, dried plant material up there, and they're all called herbs because that's how, as magical practitioners, we look at the plant kingdom that surrounds us every day. If we can process it and we understand the correspondences for it, we can apply those to our magical work.
See, I didn't know. See, I'm learning all the time. I'm reading and I'm asking questions and I'm learning. So let's talk a little bit more about this nighttime hours chart and some planetary influences, like, for example, Mars is holly and onion and poke and thistle and pine. Mm-hmm. And all of those have the same properties, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of times, I'm trying to remember what page it's on.
49.
When we talk about the
I grabbed it because I had to go back and look really quick.
What we are looking at is a few pages earlier than that when we are talking about, okay, on page 42, for instance, and you begin to get a sense of why is this herb assigned to this particular plant or planet. So you see that for plants that are ascribed to Mars, they generally will have spines or thorns. They will be protective in a proactive sense. And by that, I mean something like the peppers we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. When you bite that, you immediately get that sensation of spice, heat. And when you get your hand too close to a stove and you touch the stove, you don't sit there and go, look at that. It's kind of warm. Look at that. Oh, blistering my fingers. Wonder about that. You immediately jerk back because you know it's fire. And that's where the Mars plants, that's what we're talking about when we're talking about a proactive protection. I tell people frequently when I help my friend out at her magical shop, they will say, I need something for protections. Well, what kind of protection do you need? And they say, well, I don't know. I said, look, there are two kinds of protection. There is an active protection, and you can think of that as like a sword or a spear where you are actively going out to protect yourself. You're not waiting for something to come to you. You're not hiding. You are actively protecting yourself. And then there is the shield, hide me, you can't see me, cover me up, you know, keep people away, give me a dark shading so that you can't see me. So Mars would be protective in a proactive sense. So anything that has a defensive mechanism like the heat that we get from the capsicum or the thorns that we get with the thistle spines, they're not technically thorns, that is a proactive type of protection. And that's what we mean by, that's how we determine what plants fall into what categories. Venus will frequently have something to do with petals. That's your love plant. That is the soft mother protection, soft mother loving type energy. So if you came across a plant that had those qualities, you could probably ascribe that to Venus and not be mistaken. Airy plants fall under Mercury's purview. Anything that would have something to do with communication would fall into the purview of Mercury, because they will help you to gain those sorts of benefits in your magic. We have all of these different things, and that's where, as the ancients were ascribing different plants to different planets, that's pretty much how they were going through trying to categorize them.
Yeah, and that's something that I would never have thought about either, you know, that they certain plants have certain ties into the planets because they have the same power or mm-hmm. whatever you want to call it.
And they are most often based on the Greco-Roman pantheons, just because a lot of the influence, the Greeks and Romans had a strong influence on a lot of societies. And as this information was being rediscovered in the 1800s by the Hermetic orders and some of the other secret societies, they tended to focus quite strongly on the Greco-Roman traditions. Plus, it didn't hurt that those two societies did a pretty thorough job of writing stuff down. There are wonderful plants that can be used from the Native American traditions, but we don't always have good records of that. There are wonderful plant information that in the Celtic traditions, for instance. Those people didn't write a damn thing down.
Word of mouth.
Exactly. Yeah. And you hope that it gets passed down word of mouth, but sadly, quite a lot of that information was lost. I'm sure they had wonderful correspondences for the various herbs that they used. Some of it gets handed down, some of it doesn't, and it's unfortunate we lost it. And so quite a lot of what we have comes from the Greco-Roman traditions.
Mm-hmm. You know, you've got so much information. I mean, stuff like this in the book, things that you don't expect to see. And then when you look at it, it's like, oh, wow. You know, I mean, it's really helpful, not only for using the herbs and stuff, but for learning about different parts and the planets and all that. And, you know, like, part one of your book is Wildcrafty, which includes ground rules before you harvest, heavenly bodies that impact your plants, which we just talked about, harvesting the plants, and more. And then part two is all about the plants that you cover in the book. And there are tons of information on each plant, you know, like the history, the parts of the plant that are used, their appearance, their edibility, their warnings. I mean, this is not a huge book per se, but boy, you crammed a whole lot of stuff in there.
Thank you very much. One of the things that, again, because I do help my friend with her shop, and we live in a community that has several colleges in it, and I'm so pleased to see quite a number of young people exploring different traditions, some Wiccan, some Celtic, some Nordic. I mean, they're exploring a lot of different things. And bless their hearts, they don't have the information. I am old enough that I remember the last time interest in the witchcraft and paranormal came up was back in the 70s. And this was, of course, fed from the 1950s with Gardner and quite a number of other folks who helped to bring the traditions back. Yeah. So, you know, you become so accustomed to knowing the information, you just assume that everybody knows it. And these children, or young people, I don't want to call them children, don't want to be disrespectful, would come in and ask questions, and you look at them and go, why did you ask that question? Why don't you know this? But I can relate that to gardening as well. People who are starting out have got to start somewhere. Mm-hmm. I remember doing a Master Gardener seminar where there was a point at which people would bring plant material in to help to get help identifying diseases or insect damage or one thing and another. And a gentleman brought to me a short branch from the tree in his yard and said, "What is this?" And I looked at him and I said, are you kidding me? That's a dogwood. How can you not know what a dogwood is? But again, you got to start somewhere. So the idea of this book was to say, look, we're going to tell you, for instance, that, let's see here, poke, for example, is a good banishing herb. How do we know that? Why do we know that? Why do we use that? You're going to take my word for it? If it's one thing that we have seen on the internet, it's that quite a lot of information gets passed around that isn't well researched. So rather than build your assumptions on information that may not be correct, I was trying to give these folks a leg up to say, this is why we say follow moon correspondences. This is why we say hold your herbs in this certain fashion. This is why we say use this particular herb for this particular point. It came from this tradition. Maybe it was Greco-Roman. In a few cases, it was actually Native American. There is a reason for this. And if you know the reason behind it, it informs you and it informs your magic. The other thing that I was very keen on doing was making sure that I had gave plenty of reference material so that you don't have to just take my word for it. Go up and look up some of these books and look up some of these authors and see for yourself what the information is so that you can apply it to your magical work.
Yeah, that was amazing. I mean, it was just, you must have gone through so many things You know, I mean, you have a lot of that information in your head anyway, but boy, you sure have the backup there. When we come back from the break, which we're going to take right about now, we're going to talk about some of the craftings that are in the book that go along with some of the plants. So everybody keep yourself planted right where you are, and we'll be back in 2 minutes.
Stirring the Cauldron will be right back, so don't go away.
If you end up with webbed feet,
remember, you've been warned.
Explore the second edition of the Witch's Oracle deck through 45 innovative cards and enhanced guidebook that peers into the world of the witch. The deck's stunning artwork has a new look and includes 7 brand new inspirational cards. Each card now includes a suggested crystal or gemstone to enhance your reading, as well as a magical incantation that provides energy, reinforces the card's meaning, and helps the desired message to be sent out into the universe. The easy-to-navigate guide also has a new look and offers straightforward, gentle guidance that takes readers through both good times and bad. And now includes a chapter on crystal and gemstone divination by the amazing Nicholas Pearson. The Witch's Oracle. It is a perfect divination deck for witches as well as non-pagans, and is designed to suit both seasoned readers and beginners alike. Find out more about the Witch's Oracle deck at www.marlabrooks.com, and you can purchase the deck from schifferbooks.com, amazon.com, or order a copy from your favorite bookseller.
New Aeon Now. News and discussion of the metaphysical, the occult, the paranormal, and much, much more. With your hosts, New Aeon High Priestess Reverend Lily Alley, head of the Draken chapter of the Order of Paranormal Exploration, Christine Matza. The New Aeon is now. Join us every Thursday night at 10 p.m. Eastern for New Aeon Now.
Welcome back to Stirring the Cauldron. Once again, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
And my guest tonight is J.D. Walker, and she's the author of A Witch's Guide to Wildcraft. And during the break, I got to thinking about Samhain and got curious about certain herbs that match the Sabbat. And since Samhain is a great time for communicating with spirit, what are some of the best herbs for doing that?
Well, if you are looking for some of the herbs that you can find in your landscape, usually what we are looking for are those things that will help us to do divination. something that will help with scrying or reaching out to ancestors. And you will find that quite a lot of your Saturn herbs will do that. So that in the book, we talk about Saturn herbs being boxwood, mullein, ivy, mimosa, and morning glory. Just to use one as an example, boxwood. Boxwood is a obviously a landscape plant. It was very popular, well, obviously back in the 1800s, 1700s, 1800s, and the 1900s as well. In America, it was commonly used as a foundation plant in any of the old colonial settings, if you happen to have access to any colonial settlements, you would find the most expensive houses would probably have boxwoods around them because they were considered such a wonderful plant and almost a status symbol. They're not planted quite as much anymore because in the 80s and 90s there was a disease or an infestation of nematodes, which were tended to be deadly to the plant. So sometimes now you have to actually go to arboretums to find good collections. The National Arboretum in Washington, D.C. has a wonderful collection of boxwoods. But to get back to the point, boxwoods, because they are evergreen and so resilient and so long-lived, have an association with the afterlife. It's one of the reasons why you will see them frequently planted at cemeteries. People would be given sprigs of boxwood when someone passed away to carry to the gravesite. And then as the body was interred, then you would toss that boxwood into the gravesite as a symbol, a sign of everlasting life and life beyond what goes on in the mundane world. So if you wanted to use that, you could do a combination of boxwood and mugwort. Again, another traditional plant used for scrying, dream work, divination. You could do a great divination tea with just blending a teaspoon of mugwort and rose petals. Oddly enough, rose petals work very well for divination. But when you use it with boxwood, you can dry those two materials and burn them with your incense while you are doing outreach to your ancestors to encourage those ancestors to come and be with you during your Samhain ritual. Excuse me just a sec. About to get a little scratch in my throat there. I personally have taken and carved my rune set out of boxwood. You find the boxwood that is some stems that are at least as big around as your first finger or your thumb, and then carve the bark off. And fortunately, it's a thin bark, so it comes off pretty easily. And then you cut little discs, of course, you need to let these dry. But boxwood is a very sturdy wood. It's a very fine-grained wood. So once these have dried, you can carve your rune symbols into the boxwood or burn them. I used a wood burning tool to put my rune symbols on the boxwood. And because the boxwood has that association with the underworld, then you can use that to reach out when you are doing divination or if you are trying to contact ancestors or deities that are what we call chthonic, those deities that walk between the worlds.
Mm-hmm. You've got, on the Samhain topic, you do have a ritual in the book. You have rituals and you have spells, you have incenses, all kinds of crafts. But when I was looking through it, there was a letting go spell. And I thought, well, this is good because Samhain is a time for not dragging old stuff into the new year. You know, this is our New Year's. Mm-hmm. But in the book, it talks about letting go of a loved one, but mm-hmm. can it be anything aside from a loved one? If you're letting, like a bad habit or, something like that, Can that spell work too for that?
That is one that you can certainly do for that. I have a bit of a strong association with that spell because I created it specifically to help someone that I was fond of to get over the loss of a loved one. But you could certainly apply it to other things. I guess I'm almost proprietary of that particular spell in that I want it to ease your heart. I want it to fill your spirit so that you can continue to go on. As I say, if you don't let go of that person who has moved on, you can't survive in the mundane world. You can't follow them. You can't be with them while they are in the other realm. Hopefully you will meet them again at some other point. But while you are in the mundane world, you're going to have to focus on being in the mundane world. That doesn't mean that you can't remember and love and even miss that person that's moved on or that pet, frankly, that has moved on. A lot of people I have talked to, I've suggested this spell to whenever they have had a beloved pet pass away. But the idea is that it helps you to let go. Now, if I were working on getting rid of some bad habits or negativity in my life, I think I would want to use something a little bit more, with a little bit more oomph, a little bit more kick to it. I would probably bring in things like poke root and pepper. To help me to cut the ties that are keeping me in that bad habit or in that bad situation.
That makes sense. And I want to say that I got that because at the end of each herb that you have in there, that's where you will find the rituals or the incense or everything, you know. And that one just happened to come up under periwinkle. Now, I don't know that I've ever seen a periwinkle. I don't know, but I'd love the name. So tell me about periwinkles.
Oh, this is wonderful. You sent me a lovely banner with this for your promotions in this, and whoever put the banner together for you happened to pick a picture. It's a springtime picture, and it shows the blue flower in that picture is periwinkle.
I put that together, not knowing.
And
yeah.
You did not see there? These are the connections. This is the synchronicity. now, I do have to say that the periwinkle we are talking about is vinca, V-I-N-C-A. Usually vinca minor. That is called the sorcerer's violet. There's also a plant out there called vinca major. I suppose you could use vinca major. It doesn't have the same characteristics as vinca minor. But I wanted to stress that this is a vine growing, an evergreen vine that happens to flower around April to May, depending on where in the country it's growing. And it is not the annual that is sometimes sold as periwinkle. There is a summer annual that's great to grow in full sun, that is also called periwinkle, and that is a different plant entirely. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to explain early in the book that as aggravating as it can be, as frustrating as it can be, it's good to learn or at least be aware of the Latin names for the plants you try to use. So whenever you are reading, for instance, in a magical book and it says use periwinkle, that you don't go to the garden center and buy the annual flower because that's not the right
plant.
Yeah. But periwinkle has some wonderful folklore associated with it. Robert Folkart put together a book back in the late 1800s, I think it was, where he went through and collected a lot of information from people, you know, just basically getting folklore and such from people to help him he was trying to save a tradition, frankly, that there was concern that it might be dying out. So he was collecting a lot of these folk stories, and he is the one who says that periwinkle was frequently planted on grave sites, usually for the grave sites of children who had died very young. And it wasn't a grim mourning. It was more of the sweet sorrow, if that makes any sense. There's a difference, in my opinion, between the sweet sorrow that you sometimes feel for someone who's passed away too soon or passed away in unfortunate situations, circumstances. But periwinkle was planted on the grave as a sign of that sweet sorrow for that person having moved on. The U.S. Forest Service points out that frequently if you go through abandoned properties and you come out of nowhere across a patch of periwinkle, going, how in the world did this end up out here in the middle of nowhere? Well, there's a very good chance that someone was buried there and one of their survivors planted the periwinkle as a sign of remembrance.
Oh, yeah, the language of flowers. I love that. All the things. And I'm working, this is why I'm really getting interested in all of this more than I normally did. I mean, I grew up with a mother who was the president of the International Geranium Society for years.
Oh, my goodness.
And so, you know, she had a green thumb. So, you know, but I'm now working on an oracle card deck, which is talking to plant spirits and messages from the plants. So now, you know, I'm getting all this stuff and it's making me really, really happy.
And your mother's interest in geraniums is another good point. I'm guessing that she most likely was doing the summer, the pelargonium.
She was doing the pelargoniums or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But all the real rare ones that didn't look like geraniums either. I mean, they were ugly. They were pieces of like ginger almost, you know, little. I mean, she had them all, and the scenteds, and, you know, the zonals, and the regals, and all that. And so I grew up with geraniums all over the place. I still have a lot.
It's wonderful. Geranium is one of the, and again, we talk about geranium in the magical sense in the book, Cranesbill. When we talk about, when magical books talk about geranium, they're talking about Cranesbill, the proper geranium. The cottage flower geranium. But what your mother was working with was the plant that was imported from Africa. Mm-hmm. And that particular plant has been hybridized so extensively that you're right. It does not look like what the average person would think of when they go to the garden center and they say, I need to buy a geranium.
Yeah. It's rather amazing. I've got a question from the chat room that I don't want to overlook before time runs out. They want to know, they said, if we don't have the ability to grow our own herbs, will dried herbs work just as well as freshly picked ones?
Yes, they will. If you, for instance, if you needed to do a love spell, you can go to your kitchen cabinet and get basil. Basil is a perfectly fine, wonderful love herb. It's for bringing people together. I think it's amazing that so many times when couples are first exploring a relationship, where do they go for dinner? They go to an Italian restaurant and eat a lot of basil.
Yeah, well, oregano fits in there too, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. So the point is that if you cannot grow your own herbs and all you have is access to dried herbs, then by all means use them. Now, of course, you do need to charge them. You don't simply go to the local grocery store, buy a bottle of basil, and then come home and start to do your magic work. You do need to take that herb and charge it with your intent, and that involves setting up your ritual space, however your tradition requires it. If your tradition suggests that you call an appropriate deity, for instance, Greco-Roman, that would obviously be Aphrodite or Venus, and meditate on the energy you want that herb to have, So in this case, it would be love, and you don't have to have a particular purpose in mind at this point. You're just asking that the natural love energy in that herb come forth and be available for you to use when the time is right for your spell work, and you ask that deity to charge it, help you to charge it with the energy that you need. So you've got that nice little battery there that you can store respectfully in a proper place, and then use when you are ready to do that love work, whether it is encouraging a new love or sustaining an existing love. We do try not to recommend doing any kind of compelling love. That rarely works out well, but you know, do what you got to do.
Yeah.
And here again, that does get to the other point. So many people have told me, I can't grow plants because I'm in an apartment. It's a balcony. I can't do anything. I don't own the property, or I don't have the time to do any kind of extensive gardening. Therefore, I can't have fresh herbs. I can't gather fresh material. The point of the book was that even if you don't have the wherewithal to do this, you know, grow your own boxwoods or grow your own cranesbill, you can look carefully in your environment. And if you know what you're looking for, you can find, for instance, a wild form of cranesbill probably growing at the edge of the parking lot, because they tend to grow in tough, gravelly areas. Harvest that, dry it in your microwave. You haven't planted that cranesbill. You haven't cultivated that. You didn't have time for it. It was just there, and you discovered it. But there are a lot of plants right outside your door that you don't have to be involved with on a day-to-day basis that you can gather respectfully and use in your magical work. If you can garden even on a balcony and grow your own stuff in pots, that is awesome. That is wonderful. But again, one of the main focuses of this book was to say to you, if you don't have that option, there are plants growing all around you. And if you will learn what they are, you will find that you will have quite a supply of magical herbs right outside your door.
Yeah, I noticed that because I had something growing in the yard and I wasn't sure what it was, but it was kind of cute, so I let it go. And it turns out that it was pigweed. And I didn't know that it was edible. I mean, a lot of cultures. And so a friend of mine picked all the pigweed and it was delicious.
Oh, it
but
is.
Who knew? You know,
it is. And I just am fascinated. The seeds on pigweed are tiny. They're smaller than sesame seeds. And some poor person was out there in ancient times gathering enough of this stuff to make a bread out of it.
Dang. Yeah. I mean, there's so many things out there. I mean, you know, we all have weeds, you know, but they all have purposes, except maybe Wandering Jew. I'm not sure. it's just taking over too quickly. But
yeah, I will have to say there are a handful of plants out there for which I have not been able to find a magical purpose. To the best of my knowledge, there is no magical purpose for a plant called crownsbeard. It's a distant relative of a sunflower. Mm-hmm. Has no magical use to my knowledge of any sort.
Yeah, there just have to be things like that out there. But, you know, even if you just go looking and you will find things magically that you didn't know you had. And I got one of those. It's not the greatest thing, but I got one of those apps for the phone where you take a picture of the plant and it tells you what it is. Now, I've noticed that sometimes it's not right, but it's
You're
better
still
than
perfecting that.
It's better than nothing, you know. I mean, it's just kind of amazing.
Well, now this is one of those places or one of those times when, if you have access to Cooperative Extension in your area, and Cooperative Extension is in all 50 states. You may not live close to a Cooperative Extension office. But, for instance, in North Carolina, they have a wonderful cooperative extension, so that you can identify or you can get a plant and take it to that office and say, I think this is pigweed, but don't know for sure. Can you help me identify it? And of course, speaking of pigweeds, you want to make sure that it's not one of the toxic pigweeds. There is a giant. Yes, there is a giant hogweed you do not want to eat.
No, and that's after I ate that. Then I kind of looked it up and I thought, oh.
Oh, crap.
Well, I was fine. I'm fine. But yeah.
Well, that came up again. That was one of the points in the editing process for the book. I grew up eating pokeweed. But I will guarantee that if you look pokeweed up on the internet, one of the first things that you will read is, don't eat this plant. It's toxic. It'll make you sick. It might kill you. Well, you know, if you ate enough of it, I guess it would. If you handle it properly, mm-hmm. and for us that meant picking young tender leaves. You didn't pick the old leaves. You pick the young tender leaves. You boil them, threw that water off, put fresh water in, boiled it. You literally had to boil it at least three times. Then you can eat it, and it's a wonderful, tasty plant. But you do have to be careful about how you handle it. So be careful as you are out sourcing plant material in your yard and landscape and general area, that A, you know what you are getting, B, you know whether or not you can eat it or not, because there are some of the things out there that you truly cannot eat. And say that you collect it with respect and use it appropriately.
Yeah. I mean, again, this is a very fascinating book. There's just so much going on here and so much to learn. And, I'm like a little sponge here looking at all these things and whatever. Before we go, though, I'm sure other people want to know a little bit more about you and about your books and what you're up to. So, give out a website or the social media information so mm-hmm. people can find out all the good stuff.
Well, the book is available, obviously, through Amazon. It's available at Llewellyn.com. Folks can reach me on Facebook at House of Akasha GSO, and that's House of Akasha, AKASHA GSO, for Greensboro. So if anyone needs to reach me there, I do the Facebook page and try to keep that posted with interesting stories and information and one thing and another. So if anyone needed to reach me, they can message me through that. I do write regularly for the Llewellyn Almanacs. I wrote for many years while I was a professional business reporter. I kept my magical writings under the name J.D. Hortwart. So if you have ever seen that in the Llewellyn magical or herbal or witches almanacs, if you saw J.D. Hortwart, Hortwort, that was me. I'm currently in the editing phases of a second book that we hope to get printed with Llewellyn that kind of picks up a little bit where this one left off and focuses more on trees, the magic of trees, how these are used, can be used in magic, and then a lot more focus on certain concepts of trees, like trees of knowledge and trees of life. The world tree, that to me was an interesting concept that I just assumed everybody knew everything there was to know about it. But it turns out I would say something to someone, you know, I'm thinking about doing this book about the world tree, and they go, what?
Surprise.
I know what a world tree is. And then I learned things. I did not know that in Central America, the Mayans and Aztecs had their own version of the world tree. I was familiar with, obviously, the Nordic version, Yggdrasil, and some of the other ones throughout the European areas of the world. But I learned a lot as well. So hopefully we will get that one to market sometime next year.
Yeah, hurry up, because that sounds really, really good. And in the meantime, maybe one of these days before then, you'll want to come back and we can talk some more about plants and herbs and all kinds of things.
I would love to. That would be a pleasure.
Great. So thank you for being with us this evening, because, you know, we lived and learned, and I really enjoyed the book. And I want to thank everybody for listening in as well. And until next time, everybody, blessed be, and merry meet again. Good night.
This has been another edition of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Be sure to tune in next week at the same time for another great guest and more fun. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2009.
You have been listening to the Para-X Radio Network.